NBC presents the 24th production of its Great Plays series, the continuing story of the theater from Athens to Broadway. Your enjoyment of the Great Plays series can be greatly enhanced by your obtaining a copy of the Listener's Guide, published through the cooperation of the University Press of Columbia University in New York. Listen at the end of this program to learn how you may obtain a copy of the Great Plays Drama Guide containing complete information about this series. This afternoon, we look back on the last two decades in the American theater. These 20 years, from 1920 to 1940, embrace the real history of our theater, because within them, more good plays were written than in all the 150 years that had gone before. Within this hour, we will hear excerpts from three of the many fine plays that distinguish the period. One is the epoch-making What Price Glory by Maxwell Anderson and Lawrence Stallings. Another is the genuine American comedy by George Kelly, The Show-Off. Finally, there will be the last scene from Robert Sherwood's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Abe Lincoln in Illinois.
This was an era that began with the big guns of war still rumbling in the distance. It was an era that ended with bombs raining down out of the sky, not only on armies, but on the women and children that the men of the armies left behind. In 1920, we thought we had done with war forever. And the theater reminded us how horrible was the thing we had put aside with the play What Price Glory. Hear it now and be reminded of how much more horrible war has become. For in What Price Glory, only men, not their families, had to face it. The scene is the wine cellar of a farmhouse in a disputed French town. Headquarters of one Captain Flagg. The cellar is dimly lit by candles, and scattered about are ticks stuffed with straw. On two of them, men are asleep, tin hats on their heads, gas masks at alert on their chests. Like all their comrades, they are dirty and unshaven. As the scene opens, Sergeant Quirt enters the cellar. Speaks to Corporal Gowdy.
Captain Flagg here.
Still in the orchard, Sergeant. Digging those new rifle pits. We got 9 captured Maxims there. Those birds can't change the belts, but they can tap 1,000 rounds apiece by pressing the buttons in the dark. 15 men could hold this half of the town the way he's got the position staked out.
Well, there'll be about 15 holding it if this business of reconnoitering patrols keeps up. I'd like to have that divisional staff in this town for one night. Still bad in the square?
Pretty bad. Rifles in box rest in the railway station. Light automatics.
I thought Flagg got them out last night.
They filled it back in at dusk tonight. Our crossfire couldn't stop them. The skipper says they're working them from pulleys on the first floor. The railroad embankment covers them from us.
Running rations down that ravine every night is the toughest job I've ever soldiered.
Lucky tonight?
Pretty lucky. 6 out of 10 come back. And 2 Jameson boys got it from the same shell going down. Dutchie and the little Jew were hit right at the dump. Easy ones, though. They'll be back in 10 days.
Easy with them, huh?
Yeah.
Easy.
Who's this?
It's Flagg, the captain. And Aldrich.
Easy, Aldrich. Spread a blanket there.
Yeah, sure.
Right here, Aldrich. Give me a stick of that dough, Paulson.
Yeah. Here, sir. A quart of greens, Captain.
All right. Take these 2 now, Aldrich. I'm putting the others in your blouse. Get somebody to give you 1 every 3 hours till you carry it out.
What are they?
Morphine, quarter grains.
What if I take them all when your back is turned?
Go ahead. It's your affair.
Where is he? Where is he? Where's Aldrich?
Take it easy, Moore.
Where's Aldrich? Dave, they got you. They got your beauty, the dirty swine.
Yeah, take it easy, kid. Take it easy.
Oh, why do they keep us in this hellish town? Why can't they send in some of the million men we've got back there and give us a chance? Men in my platoon are so hysterical every time I get a message from Flagg, they want to know if they're being relieved. What can I tell them? They look at me like whipped dogs as if I'd just beaten them. I've had enough of them this time. I've got to get them out, I tell you. They've had enough every night the same way. And since 6 o'clock, there's been a wounded sniper in the tree by that orchard angle crying, "Comrade, comrade," just like a big, crippled whippoorwill. What price glory now? Oh, why can't we all go home? Who cares about this stinking little town? You talk about courage, and all night long you hear a man who's bleeding death in the tree calling you and asking you to save him. I won't stand for it. I won't stand for it. I won't have the platoon asking me every minute of the live long night when they're going to be relieved. Flank, I tell you, you can shoot me, but I won't stand for it. I'll take him out tonight. Tell you, we'll get my word.
Yeah, boy. You can't do this before all these men. They're rubbed up, too. Now, you're all tuckered out on your side of the line. Don't worry about your platoon. We'll get them out. You turn in here and doze off for a while. That's it. Give him a blanket.
Yeah, Captain.
Take it easy a while, and you can go back to your platoon and time to stand, too. Sleep it off, boy. Sleep it off. You're in a deep, wide hole, and the shells can't get you. Sleep it off, Moore.
Here, Mr. Moore. Just a little chocolate I bought off a YMCA wagon down at the base. I got hit myself once. Here in Nicaragua. We were washed up before we made a landing. I was a corporal then, and when we were scrubbing down and putting on clean uniforms, doctor's orders, you know, so they wouldn't have to wash us when we were hit. A bird says to me, it was old Smoke Plankett who was killed in 1913 at a joint in Yokohama. Smoke says to me, you'd better swab down, Quirt, because I dreamed last night that he wrote your name on a bullet. I said to him, the bullet ain't been cast that can shoot Mickey Quirt. And he said, if your name's on one, it'll turn the corner and go upstairs to find you. Well, that afternoon when we made a landing and hit the beach, it was on a hill about 500 yards offshore. We started up the hill. Weren't many of us dropping. And I came to a log. I had to jump. And I lost my balance, and I threw my hand up in the air. Look, right through the fin, as pretty as a pinwheel. Smoke saw it. Oh, yeah, your Weisenheimer, he says to me, your name was on that one, and you had to reach up for it. Rations in, Captain Flagg. Lost the two Jameson boys in the ravine going down, both badly hit. Lost Fleischman and Rosenthal in the dump, both slight. Brought back all the ammunition and two sacks of bread. One of Can Willie French. I carried a sack of beet sugar on my back. Got a piece of shrapnel in it where they're shelling the crossroads. Stopped it square. In the next war, I'm going to wear a suit of beet sugar and stand forest fire watching the Rocky Mountains. Oh, I brought up two of those 30-day wonder lieutenants from a training camp sent up by a divisional for instruction.
Instruction? Listen, I won't stand for it. They wipe their dirty feet on this company. They can give my men all their good jobs. They can keep us in the line all during the whole war. But if my sergeants have got time to teach Army lieutenants how to button
They're
up
They're in my hole now, Captain. Pretty barely shaken up by the ravine. First time up, you know. Shall I send them to you, sir?
Send them to me. And don't call me sir anymore tonight.
All right. Gowdy.
Yeah?
You heard him. Hit the deck. Bring him in.
All right, Sergeant.
Those Huns in the railway station again, Captain?
Right across the town square when there's a flare-up, and you'll see.
Well, you'll get a visit from brigade headquarters tonight. I saw their party in the ravine as we were going down to the dump.
Yeah, the old man says we got to drive them off the embankment. He can give me 5 general courts, and I'll not waste another man at that business. It'll take a brigade action to get them out for good.
Do you mind if I take a look around there now? I'd like to see this war some. For 6 days, I've been a bakery wagon. Haven't seen a spigot yet except stinking dead ones. I never see soldiers stink like these heinies.
All right, go get your head blown off, but bury yourself while you're about it. The burying detail is in for the night.
Oh, gosh, I wish I was home.
Well, get one of them Alsatian lieutenants in, and you'll get a leave.
I don't want to die yet, thinking you're just the same. Well, here goes.
Keep your head down. I can't waste any gravediggers on sergeants.
How do you feel, Aldrich?
All right, Ken.
I'm sorry Moore blew up that way, Aldrich. You're a lot luckier than he is, but he doesn't know it. I'll have you out tomorrow night with a ration detail. You'll be parking your body in a big white bed in another 2 days. Good luck. Been a good man. I wish I could get you a ribbon for this
time. All right. Here. Here's the captain.
Well, well, well. The new lieutenants. Let me look at you. So. This is the last of the old guard, eh? In the name of holy sweet jumping, are you gentlemen bound for a masked ball that you come disguised as officers? Or do you wish to save the snipers the trouble of picking you off of the glass that you wear signboards?
Can't you go without those trench coats, even to the trenches? How long can you last in them boots? Take them off before you even part your hair in the morning. My name is Flagg, gentlemen. I'm the sinkhole and cesspool of this regiment. Frowned on in the YMCA huts and sneered at by the divisional Beau Brummels. I'm a good-for-nothing company commander. I corrupt youth and lead little boys astray into the black shadows between the lines of hell, killing more men than any other company commander in the regiment, and drawing all the dirty jobs in the world. I take chocolate soldiers and make dead heroes out of them. I didn't send for you, Mr.
Cunningham, sir.
Not for you.
Lundstrom, sir.
And I confess I'm in a quandary. 4 days ago, I should have been more hospitable, for I had 4 gunnery sergeants then. Now I have 2, and I can't spare them to teach little boys how to adjust their diapers. I've no doubt that one of you is an all-American halfback and the other the editor of a college paper. But we neither follow the ball nor the news here. We're all dirt, and we propose to die in order that Corps headquarters may be decorated. We should be happy to receive suggestions as to just what should be done with you. Ah, I have it. There are 2 German gunners over there in the enemy railway station. 2 bright young men might get them out and cut their throat before dawn. Then no more could get into the station all day. 2 bright young men who know very little of anything just yet. I have 2 bright ones. But they're far too valuable. They're corporals with 10 years' experience.
I'll do anything you will. Where is this railway station and the 2 bucks that got you buffaloed?
Why, it's Frank Merriwell. All right, Frank, you and me will be playing ball in hell by 3 o'clock this morning.
Put me in 2.
Oh, no. We must have officers left. Rule of the game, must have officers. Men would get right up and go home, and then there wouldn't be any war at all. Besides, 3 would be a crowd, and I hate crowds early in the morning around the railway station. They're so noisy, and they die so fast. Got it.
Yeah, Captain?
Take Mr. Lundstrom to the 4th platoon sergeant and tell him that here's his new officer.
Yes, sir.
And by the way, Mr. Lundstrom, they filter through and bomb 2 a week. Small parties slipping down that ravine you'll find in your left. Watch it closely or you'll all have your throats cut before you know it. And let that sergeant sleep for the next 2 days. Remember, he'll do no details till he's rested. Of course, you can wake him for advice. That's all. Shove off.
Very good, sir.
Bah. Enough to drive a man nuts. Quirt. What's the matter with you?
How do you do, Captain? Got a can opener for this bandage, kid?
You crook. You got a leg wound.
Yep. I say, Captain, you got a can opener?
Those things are supposed to be open with the teeth.
You don't say. Well, this one wasn't. This here one was evidently made for the Red Cross by the Red Simon Company. Like as not, instead of bandages, I'll find a mess of goldfish in it.
Where were you? Where were you?
Just looking around.
Here.
Thanks.
Where were you, I said?
In the vegetable garden, pulling turnips.
Quirt. I believe you stuck your leg out.
Listen, if I wanted to stick my leg out, don't you think I had plenty of chance to do it before? No, sir. I stuck my head out. Some bird in the church tower took a shot at me. There she is. Look at her. Nice, huh? In and out without touching the bone. Here, now, Jimmy, let me squeeze the juice out of it. She'll be all right. Ain't she the prettiest little punk you ever saw, Captain? Ain't she a beauty?
I suppose you think you're going back to Cognac Pete's, huh?
How did you guess it? Yes, sir. Back to my little skookum lady you try to make me a present of. Am I happy? Am I happy? Oh, boy, ask me, Captain, am I happy?
You mean to say you ain't cured of Charmaine yet?
Cured of Charmaine? No, sir, I ain't even getting better. Oh, Captain Flagg, ain't you proud of yourself? Ain't you a wizard? Oh, ain't I sorry to leave you alone here in all this mess? Think of her sitting on my lap, lighting my pipe in the kitchen, and you dodging machine guns. I wonder I don't bust out crying. You know, I wouldn't wonder if you got bumped off and never came back. As a matter of fact, I hope you get your head blown off.
Yeah, you always did have a charming disposition.
Oh, pretty baby, Papa doesn't mean to hurt you. Oh, look it, Captain. I wouldn't take $100 mix for that little bumblebee that flew in my leg there.
You feel pretty cocky, don't you? Well, you can't go out tonight. I guess you can work all right with that. You'll wait here till Cunningham and I get back with that Alsatian shave tail from the railroad embankment. Then I get leave, The company gets a rest, and we both go back together. See?
Not much, I don't see. I've got a very important engagement back at Pete's place, and it can't be postponed, not even for the pleasure of your enjoyable company, such as it is. I don't wait for nothing in the world but a medical test.
Why, you Captain dirty...
Knight. Yeah. I heard your first sergeant was hitting that turnip patch, Captain. Oh, here you are. Well, let's have a look.
Yeah, right there.
Can you walk, Sergeant?
Well, that depends on what I see, mate.
Go to the sick bay at once for a shot of tetanus, and then get out of here. You can reach a collecting station before you're done.
Oh, thanks. Oh, ain't this heartbreaking, Flag. Well, duty calls, but my eyes fill with tears at the thought of leaving my old company commander. I don't know as I can go through with it.
There, well, make it snappy. You'll find the door locked.
Yeah? What door?
Charmaine's.
Huh. Are you wounded too, Mr. Flagg?
No, but inside 10 minutes I'm going to be wounded or bumped off or have that prisoner for headquarters.
Try to get killed, will you? To please me. Just this once.
Mr. Cunningham.
Yes, sir.
Come here. Please. Guess you thought I was joking when I proposed that little expedition to the railroad embankments.
I did not. When do we start?
Well, I was. I was kidding. I'd no more let you go in there, boy, than I'd knife you in the back. The air's full of steel this side of the embankment, and a green man has about as much chance as a cootie on Fifth Avenue.
Are you going?
I got official reasons for going, see? Brigadier wants a prisoner, and he also wants that nest wiped out. Also, I got private and personal reasons for wanting to catch up with that baboon that got the little present through his leg.
Yeah, if you're going, that suits me. I ain't no green man. I can crawl on my belly.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm a locomotive engineer. Been crawling under trains for 15 years. And several engines shot out from under me likewise. You think you can scare me with this here war? You ought to see a few railroad wrecks.
Well, Mr. Cunningham, I'm inclined to think you'll do.
You bet I'll do.
All right. What do you say we block our faces and give a little party now the guests will be asleep?
Sure. I like the cut of your jib. You can lead me to it. But show me which one is a lieutenant so I won't hurt him.
You from Texas?
You hit it.
Now I get you. So we got another Texan in this outfit wanting to fight anybody that ain't from Texas.
Yeah, and ain't no college boy neither.
Good stuff. Now throw away them fancy dress clothes of yours and dip in here.
Sure. I was a locomotive engineer in the Louisiana Midland. Three wrecks in my division last year. This war is sure a great relief to me. Yeah. I'm an engineer officer attached to infantry. My brother's still driving an engine back home. Had a letter from him last month. He said, "You dirty yellow sapsucker quitting your job on the Louisiana Midland?" I knew he always was a yellow pup, but I didn't think you'd go back on the road that way.
No, if we only had a pretty little engine.
Hey, what's that?
A ring.
Don't shoot him! Don't shoot that man! We've got one, boys! We've got a live one!
All right, mister, get in there!
Okay, cease fire!
Captain Flagg! Captain Flagg! Hey. We got a prisoner, sir.
Bring him over here. Let me have a look at you, sweetheart. Let me have a look. Boys, he's an Alsatian lieutenant. He couldn't wait for us to go after him, so he come over. Oh, sweetheart, you're the sweetest sight I've seen since Charmaine. Here, Kuiper, take care of him for me, and for Lord's sake, don't scare him to death, because he's our ticket to leave.
Hey, we'll pack up and we'll have you like that. Right back in old
dinner.
Hey.
Get the flag.
Who's that?
It's little
Lewison,
sir.
Lewison, bring him in.
Get the flag. Get the flag. Stop the blood. Stop the blood.
I can't stop it, Lewison. I'm sorry. Pitch him with your needle, mate.
Yeah. Oh, Captain Flagg. Can't you please, sir? Stop the blood.
Easy with him. Lay him down easy. That's... Oh, no.
You'll be all right, boy. You'll be all right.
Yeah. You'll be all right.
The scene you have just heard, Sergeant Quirt was played by Walter Kinsella, Captain Flagg by Ted DeCorsia, Corporal Gowdy by John Griggs, Lieutenant Ulrich by Raymond Edward Johnson, Lieutenant Moore by Joe Helgeson, Lieutenant Cunningham by Spencer Bentley, the pharmacist's mate by Billy Lee, and Private Lewison by Paul Dubov. What Price Glory produced in 1924... for the first time, stripped war of the romantic legend that had surrounded it in the theater. It was a vivid example of the new realism that had come to the theater in 1920. Looking back, it is possible to see the first symptoms of this realism in the founding of the Little Theater by Maurice Brown in Chicago in 1915, the organization of the Provincetown, Washington Square, and Neighborhood Players in New York in 1915. The first public performance of Eugene O'Neill play in 1916, and the beginnings of the Theatre Guild in 1919. All these factors combined to transform the American theatre from a comparatively weak institution, peopled by unbelievable characters expounding dramatic themes of no more substance than cotton candy, into a dynamic force.
With O'Neill showing the way, a new school of dramatists appeared, writers of wit and power. Howard, Anderson, Stallings, Behrman, Barry, Rice, Lawson, Kelly, and Kaufman were the first of a much longer list of able playwrights. O'Neill wrote Beyond the Horizon, Anna Christie, and The Hairy Ape, and thus whetted the public's appetite for more plays dealing with problems of social significance. Then came other plays that satisfied this appetite, plays like Nice People, Ambush, The Adding Machine, Hell Bent for Heaven, and, as we have just seen, What Price Glory.
But as realism came to the theater, people outside the theater began to take on an air of unreality. For instance, it is a matter of solemn record that on a summer day in 1930, a flagpole sitter perched atop a theater building near Times Square, New York, made a momentous decision. He climbed down. Now, this action, as much as anything else, signaled the end of an era, the end of the gay and glamorous 20s. At the moment the flagpole sitter reached the sidewalk, another character of the era that was to follow was piling bright red apples on the top of a wooden box and putting into place a bit of cardboard with the device, apples 5 cents. As the former flagpole sitter passed the apple salesman, one era, in a manner of speaking, passed another. And what might these two have to say to each other? Well, it's anybody's guess.
Apples. Apples, 5 cents. Help the unemployed. A nice big red apple for a nickel. Buy now. Put your money to work. Help bring back prosperity. Apples, 5 cents. Apples.
Hey, buddy. Let me ask you something.
Apples and apples, sir. 5 cents. Your choice, sir. Take any one at all.
Yeah, give me an apple. Now, let me ask you something. What's been going on down here?
Down here?
Yeah, down here. Well, maybe I'd better explain it to you. You see, for the last 10 years, I've been sitting on flagpoles. I'm a flagpole sitter, see?
Oh, indeed.
Indeed, yeah. It's always been good for a laugh, if you understand what I mean. I go from one town to another making deals with restaurant men or scorekeepers to put a sign on my back and then climb a flagpole. It never fails. But today, for the first time, I notice something's wrong.
Yes?
I'm rounded on my first week. Just getting warmed up, you might say. And then...
Yes?
I look down, and for the first time, I notice...
Yes?
Nobody's looking at me.
Nobody's looking at you? Oh, is that all? Apples? Apples, 5 cents. Buy now. Buy now and help bring back prosperity. Apples, 5 cents.
But look, buddy, it's got me worried.
What's got you worried?
Why don't they look at me no more?
Well, it's a long story.
Well, let me hear it. Here, have something yourself. Take an apple.
Well, I don't mind if I do. I'll take this one here. I, I'll eat it later, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Now, your question was this, I believe. Why don't people look at you anymore?
Yeah, that's right. Why don't they look at me no more?
Well, by the way, what is your name, sir?
O'Boyle. Boxcar O'Boyle. Champion flagpole sitter of the universe. Call me Boxcar.
Yes, of course, yes. Well, I am J. Parker Upturn, investment counselor. I'm in Apples at the moment.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mr. Upturn.
Boxcar, come to the point.
Yeah?
The reason that people have stopped looking at you up there on your flagpole is that people have changed. Times have changed. Times have changed incredibly. Boxcar, you recall the war.
Do I? I climbed my first flagpole on Armistice Day.
Yes, and a great deal of that went on, as I recall. Howsomever, we did many strange things after the war. In a burst of fervor, we voted hard liquor out of the saloons and into the home. Women cut off their hair to their ears and their dresses to their knees and began to smoke cigarettes and put on makeup. Young people labeled themselves the lost generation and provoked a complete revolution in manner and morals. Do you follow me, Boxcar?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Restlessness and discontent were rife. People seized on every fad and fancy that came along. At one time, it was necessary to master a Chinese game called Mahjong or be left completely out of things socially.
Yeah?
A Frenchman named Emile Coué arrived in New York and soon had the whole country repeating after him, "Day by day, in every way, I'm getting better and better." A gross overstatement, Boxcar.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the era of the bum steer, Boxcar. There were many false prophets. Of prohibition, they said, "This is a great experiment which will result in a nation that knows not alcohol." Of Florida real estate, they said, "Here is the rarest opportunity in all American history to invest in land that will double and triple in value before it's stabilized on a permanently high level."
Yeah, yeah. I sat on a flagpole in Miami.
The stock market boomed, Boxcar. Of the stock market, the prophets said that here was an opportunity unparalleled in all American history.
Hey, wait a minute. Wasn't that the Florida boom?
Of course. It was also said of the stock market. Experts pointed out with some irritation, Boxcar, that there was no longer the slightest excuse for a man not to be financially independent in his old age. All that was necessary to do, Boxcar, was to consult an investment counselor, follow his advice, and then recline to await dividend checks of $100 a week at the age of 55.
Yeah, yeah, but Mr. Upton, what I want to know is, why don't they look at me no more?
Patience, my dear Boxcar, patience. People fed on sensations, Boxcar. They applauded all who supplied even a momentary diversion. To become a popular hero, it was necessary only to swim the English Channel or to fly nonstop between one point and another point that had never been flown nonstop before. Then, having done that, one reported to the Battery at the southernmost tip of Manhattan Island at 11:45 a.m. There, one found a reception committee, and with this committee, one proceeded up Broadway. Along the sidewalks, people who took their lunch between 12 and 1 o'clock cheered, while from the windows of the skyscrapers, people who took their lunch between 1 and 2 o'clock tore up telephone books and threw rolls of tissue paper from the windows.
But what I want to know...
Silence. Things went from bad to worse. People demanded more and more sensations. To satisfy this appetite, marathon dances were held, and young men and young women staggered around dance floors for weeks on end. In Chicago, a man climbed a flagpole and sat on it, while down in the streets, thousands cheered and traffic was at a standstill.
That was me. I was the guy. I climbed the flagpole in Chicago. Oh, I was a wow. I panicked.
Naturally, Boxcar. You, and along with you, Mahjong, Emile Coué, crossword puzzles, New York receptions, bathtub gym. You were a symbol of the era.
Yeah? A symbol?
Precisely, Boxcar.
But why don't they look at me no more?
Because, my dear Boxcar, the era has ended.
You mean flagpole sitting has passed out?
I am afraid so, Boxcar.
Well, it was good while it lasted. Hey, but look, I gotta do something. What am I gonna do?
Well, Boxcar, I don't advise professionally anymore. But as you see, I am in Apples.
Apples? not a bad idea. I'll get me some apples. Thanks. I'll get me some apples right now. So long, Mr. Upton. I'll just get me some apples right now.
But boxcar...
Yeah, Mr. Upton?
If you don't mind, the other side of the street, please.
Despite the strange shenanigans of the world outside, from flagpole sitting, as interpreted by John Griggs, to apple selling, as interpreted by Fred Irving Lewis, the American theater was distinguishing itself in a radical departure from a tradition that included considerable ham acting and ham playwriting.
I protest, sir. I most emphatically protest.
You protest what, my dear fellow?
I protest your implication, sir, that the American theater offered nothing of consequence prior to 1920. That, sir, is a canard.
Well, there are two sides to every question, Mr...
My name is Herringbone, sir. Carter Herringbone.
I take it from your stovepipe hat and beaver collar, Mr. Herringbone, that you were...
I am an actor, sir. Here. Here, let me show you something. This clipping. A review from the Belleville, Illinois Argus. I played there in 1904. Read alone. Now, the part about me is along toward the end.
Oh, down here.
Yes.
It says, Elsie Horter, John Haverford, and Carter Herringbone left little to be desired in the supporting roles. Well, it's a very good notice.
It's just one of hundreds.
Mr. Herringbone, as I say, there are two sides to every question. I was merely making the point that as an institution, the American theater was more vital and realistic between 1920 and 1940... than in all the years that had gone before. If you disagree...
I disagree most violently. Now, mind you, I make no case for the 19th century. But since the year 1900, we have had an abundance of fine playwrights. Have you never heard of Belasco, of George Ade, of George M. Cohan, or Clyde, Sheldon, Gillette, Eugene Walter, and Louis Ansparker?
Oh, of course. I don't mean to say a word against them. My only point is that the playwrights of the last two decades brought realism to the theater. They wrote about American problems.
Oh, I forgot to mention Clyde Fitch. What about Fitch?
Oh, excellent. Well, we had a play of his in this series. My point
Your is that... Your point is rubbish, my friend. Pure rubbish. Why, in my day, the theater was vital. Alive, there was drama in the theater. Every village, every hamlet in the nation had a theater and opera house. And New York companies visited them regularly. Why, Rip Van Winkle in Old Kentucky, and plays like that toured for years and years.
I don't deny that theater going was more popular, Mr. Herringbone. My point is that the plays themselves lacked significance.
Significance? Rubbish. Who cares about significance? People go to the theater to be entertained.
Well, perhaps, but I don't think playwrights should completely ignore what is going on in the world. They did, you know, for many, many years, but beginning with 1920...
Now, be specific, my friend. Give me some problems they solved, these modern playwrights of yours.
Well, I don't know if they solved any problems, Mr. Herringbone, but I'll tell you some plays that examined a few. For instance, after What Price Glory, the play They Knew What They Wanted exposed some of the difficulties of prohibition, among other things. Craig's Wife showed to what ends overzealous housekeeping could be carried. The Great God Brown reveals the attempts of a sensitive genius to adjust himself to a world which he finally concludes to be empty. There was a play called The Racket, showing how crime and politics were sometimes linked together. There was Gods of the Lightning, based on the Sacco Vanzetti case, and They Shall Not Die, based on the Scottsboro case. The Last Mile condemned overcrowded and mismanaged prisons.
All very well, my good friend, but not good theater. People go to the theater to be entertained.
Ah, yes, Mr. Herringbone, but our modern playwrights were entertaining, too. For instance, there was The Show-Off by George Kelly. I think you might enjoy meeting Mr. Aubrey Piper from that play, Mr. Herringbone. So if you'll make yourself comfortable, we'll have a look at him. The immediate situation revolves around so simple a thing as a glass of water for Aubrey. But Aubrey can make even that an occasion.
And hurry along, darling. Hurry along.
All right, dear. I'll get it for you right away.
Now what's the matter, Amy?
Oh, nothing, Mother. Aubrey wants a drink of water.
Oh.
Now stay right where you are, folks. Right where you are. Just a little social attention. Going right out again, the next train.
Good.
Oh, there you are, Mother. Well, I'm any woman's fancy. What do you say, huh? Even to the little old coronation? Oh. Say, come on, Amy. Step on the United Gas out there. Customer in here waiting for the old Aquapura. Man's got to have something to drink. How about it, Pop? Huh? You stay with me on that, won't you? Yes, sir. I want to tell those of you who ventured out this evening that this is a very pretty little picture of domestic felicity. Father reading and mother knitting. But then Mama is always knitting. And little old Tommy Edison over there working 18 hours a day to make the rich man richer and the poor man poorer. What about a popcorn, huh? Right or raving, huh? Sign on the dotted line. Say, what's this? Little old Popsy Wopsy getting sore and going to leave us flat? Nevertheless, notwithstanding, Mrs. Fisher, I'd like to mention that the kid from West Philadelphia is giving the growing boy the said and done.
Oh.
Ah, there she is. Amy herself, and not a moving picture. Blushing as she gave it, looking down at her feet so bare, and her tattered gown.
Oh,
how's that, Mother Fisher? Huh? You can't beat that little old Willie Shakespeare, can you? No, sir, I'd like to tell the brothers that that little old Shakespeare shook a wicked spear. Well, here's laughter, ladies. And Mr. Marconi, my best regards to you.
I'm afraid it's not very cold.
Why didn't you let it run?
Well, I did, but it doesn't seem to get any colder.
Mm, very nice indeed. And a sweeter draught from a fairer hand was never quaffed.
Oh, you.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, sir, Mr. Joseph, I want to tell you that you're wasting your time. But when you're all through, they'll offer you 20 cents for it and sell it for 20 million. Take it or leave it, sign on the dotted line. Yes, sir, that's exactly what they did a little old yours truly here. 20 Lincoln Anacondas for a formula that would have solved the greatest problem before the industrial chemical world today. A formula to prevent the rusting of iron and steel. A solution of vanadium and manganese to be added to the metal in its molten state instead of applied externally as they have been doing.
Mom, do you know anything about that little screwdriver, the black
But handle? Simply because it was discovered by a working man.
You mean
man,
the one you fixed the sewing machine with?
Yeah, that little short one with a black handle.
They gave it the swinging door.
I think I saw it on that shelf over the sink.
All right, Mom.
And Joe, don't go upsetting everything
They'd
out
rather
there.
Go on paying $1 million a year to paint their steel and iron structures throughout the country than to pay me.
Do you see it, Joe?
And do you know why, Mrs. Fisher?
No.
Then I'll tell you. Because I work for my living. That's the said and done of the whole business. Keep them poor and get them married. And then, as my darling old mother used to say, quote, you've got them on their beams and hinges, unquote.
Hmm. Well, I don't see that anybody's trying to make anybody get married if they don't want to.
Oh, but they do, Mrs. Fisher. But the capitalist wants to stop them.
Yeah? Well, I guess it'd be just as well to stop some of them.
Oh, don't you go back on little old William Jennings Bryan, Mother Fisher. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know. Sign on the dotted line.
Oh, come on into the parlor, Aubrey.
Yes, sir, Amy, I want to tell you, it's the poor man that gets it every time. I put a question up to Secretary Mellon in a letter 6 weeks ago that absolutely stumped him. Because I haven't heard a line from him since.
Oh, come on.
I simply asked him to what extent his proposed program of income tax revision would affect the Great American Railroad employees.
Her family to the contrary, Amy Fisher loves Aubrey, and in time they are married and established in two rooms up over a barber shop. Of course, Aubrey, who is making $32.50 at the moment, has grander plans.
Now, Mother Fisher, I want a home. Something with a bit of ground around it. Where I can do a bit of tennis in the evening if I feel like it.
If you do, he'll pay for it.
That's exactly what I expect to do, Mother Fisher. Not giving you a short answer, that's exactly what I expect to do. But I want what I'm paying for, I'll tell you that. No more of this old first-of-the-month business for this bambino. Oh, no. He's all washed up and signed on the dotted line.
They're not putting up any more houses from what I hear.
Oh, be yourself now, Mother Fisher. Be yourself.
Well, where are they?
Oh, you ought to go out along the boulevard some Sunday and see what they're doing out there.
Yeah, well, there's no danger of you going out along the boulevard. Except for a walk.
A lot of people out that way, Mother.
Well, if there is, they're paying a lot more than you're able to pay.
Now, a man's got to live somewhere, Mother.
Yes. But if he's wise, he'll live where he's able to pay. Unless he wants to be moving half a dozen times a year, like a lot of them are doing. Making a big show. buying $10,000 houses and putting $50 down. Besides, you ain't got any furniture, even if you did get a house. Because you want to sit on the floor.
Oh, the matter of furniture nowadays, little mother, is a very inconsequential item, from what I can gather.
Well, you ought to price it sometime when you're in the city and see how inconsequential it is.
I've investigated the matter very thoroughly, Mrs. Fisher. And I find that there are at least 15 establishments right here in this city that will furnish a man's house from garret to garage and give him the rest of his life to pay for it.
Now, they'd have to give some of them the rest of their lives at the rate they're going now.
Oh, give the growing boy a chance, Mrs. Fisher. Give the growing boy a chance. Do you know what Mr. L.D. Brophy of the American Can Company said in the September number of the American Magazine, don't you?
No, I
don't. Well, I'll tell you. He said, quote, "I would say to the innumerable host of young men standing on the threshold of life, uncertain and mayhap dismayed, as they contemplate the stress of modern industrial competition, Rome was not built in a day," unquote. Those were his very words. I wouldn't kid you. And I think the old boy's got it right, if you ask me.
What are you going to the automobile show tonight for?
Repeat the question, Mrs. Fisher, if you please.
I say, what are you going to the automobile show for?
Married 5 months ago today, Mother. Got to celebrate the happy event.
I see.
Besides, one never knows what a day will bring in the way of an opportunity to satisfy a long-felt want.
No.
And since she knocks but once at each man's door, the kid here doesn't want to miss his chance by any uncertainty as to just what choo-choo he prefers. Well, gotta run along now, Mother, and see if baby's back in the house yet.
Aubrey has borrowed a car from a friend to attend the automobile show. He returns with his head bandaged, but otherwise master of the situation as usual.
Little mother, control yourself. I assure you there's no occasion for undue solicitation. Oh, good evening, Mrs. Highland.
Hello. What happened to your head?
You look like a bandit.
Oh, the veriest trifle, Mrs. Highland. Just a little spray from the windshield.
And the car is smashed too, I guess.
Well...
Ain't it?
Mother Fisher... It is now in the hands of the bandits of the law. The judicial gentlemen who have entered into a conspiracy with the regulators of traffic to collect fines from motorists by ordering them to go one way and then swearing that they told you to go another.
Never mind your fancy talk. We've had too much of that already. I want to know who you killed or what you run into, for I know you ran into something.
Why, Mother Fisher.
And just where is the car someone was fool enough to lend you?
The automobile, little mother, is perfectly safe. Park and pasturing... in the courtyard of the 22nd and Huntington Avenue police station.
And did you get arrested, too?
I accompanied the officer as far as the station house, yes. I told them a few things, too, while I was there, about the conditions of traffic in this city.
Guess they told you a few things, too, didn't they?
Beg pardon?
Oh, never mind. You're welcome.
What'd they do? Fine you, Aubrey?
They were all set to find me. But when I got through with them, they didn't have a leg to stand on.
Oh.
So they tried to cover themselves up as gracefully as possible by trumping up a charge against me of driving an automobile without a license.
Well, what did they do? Take the automobile away from you?
Nothing of the sort. They simply complied with the usual procedure in a case of this kind, which is to release the defendant on bond pending the extent of the victim's injuries.
Was somebody injured?
The traffic cop that ran into me, yes.
Oh, good grief. Well, couldn't you find anybody but a traffic cop to run into?
Oh, I did not run into him, Mrs. Highland. You don't understand the circumstances of the case.
Well, I understand this much about them, that they can give you 10 years for a thing like that.
Oh.
Well, and serve you right, too. Land, you're borrowing people's automobiles and knowing no more about running them than I do.
No time like the present to learn, Mrs. Highland.
Well, you very likely have plenty of time from now on. That officer's seriously injured.
Well, he was faking a broken arm around there when I left. But it's a wonder to me that the poor straw ride wasn't signed on the dotted line because he ran head-on right into me.
Was he in a car, too?
No, he was jaywalking. He was trying to beat me to the crossing after giving me the right of
way. Well, where did this thing happen?
Broad and Erie Avenue. I wouldn't kid you.
They take the cop to the hospital?
Well, yes, we took him over there in the car.
They let you run it?
Repeat the question, Mrs. Highland.
You heard me. I don't need to repeat it. Oh, and take that silly-looking bandage off your head before Amy sees you and you frighten the life out of her. She's got enough to worry her now without looking at you.
In the end, though, Aubrey has his day. Joe Fisher sells his invention, and for once his show-off brother-in-law commands respect in the Fisher household.
You know, it was a funny thing, Mum. Hmm? When I first talked to the Myers and Stevens people, I was only to get $50,000 advance. And when I went up there today, they had the contracts all made out for $100,000.
I'm getting away with murder at that,
Joe. Oh, keep still. You don't know anything about this at all.
Well, I made them think I knew something about it.
You made who think?
The Meyer and Stevens people.
Do you know what you're talking about, Aubrey?
Certainly I know what I'm talking about. I went to see those people last Saturday afternoon, after you told me that you talked to them.
And what'd you do up there?
Well, I told them that they'd have to double the advance if they wanted to do business with us.
And what business was it of yours?
Well, I'm Joe's guardian, ain't I?
Who told you were?
Well, he's got to have somebody tend to his business, doesn't he? Why, he's only a lad.
He don't need you. He tended to his own business long before he ever saw you.
Well, what did you say to them, Aubrey?
Well, I simply told them that your father was dead.
Oh.
And that I was acting in the capacity of business advisor to you.
Huh?
And that if this discovery of yours was as important as you had led me to believe that it was, they were simply taking advantage of your youth by offering you $50,000 for it. And that I refused to allow you to negotiate further unless they double the advance, market it at their own expense, and one half the net. Sign on the dotted line.
I know.
Well, I certainly have to give you credit, Aubrey. That's just the way the contract reads.
Yes, I told it to them, and I told it to your lawyer, too.
I'll have to give you a little present of some kind out of this, Aubrey.
Oh, you'll not give me any present, Joe. Give it to your mother. She'll need it more than I will.
Why, Aubrey?
Oh, Amy, have you got the financial page there?
Is this it, Aubrey?
Yes. Thank you, dear, thank you.
Oh, Aubrey. You're wonderful.
Well, a little bit of bluff goes a long way sometime, Amy. Sign on the dotted line.
Isn't he wonderful, Mom?
Heaven help me from now on.
In these excerpts from the show-off, Aubrey Piper, the show-off himself, was played by Spencer Bentley, Amy Fisher by Elaine Kent, Mrs. Fisher by Florence Malone, Joe Fisher by Joe Helgeson, and the married Fisher daughter, Clara Highland, by Betty Kane. Well, Mr. Herringbone, I should think the show-off would supply even your appetite for entertainment in the theater.
Ah, indeed it does. But I didn't detect the playwright wrestling with any great problem in it. You're supposed to be making some such point, you know.
I haven't forgotten, Mr. Herringbone. Let's get into the 1930s. The decade opened with a biting musical satire directed against political machines called Of Thee I Sing, as entertaining as it was significant. Then Eugene O'Neill wrote a psychological study of a family's decay, Mourning Becomes Electra. The animal kingdom attacked traditional marriage ceremonies, and both your houses exposed the lack of genuine representation in government. Sidney Kingsley wrote Men in White, presenting the doctor's dilemma in choosing between life as ordinary men live it and service. Bury the Dead came along as an attack on propaganda, a play that would not have been well received if What Price Glory had not paved the way for it.
Are you finished?
Not yet, Mr. Herringbone. Robert Sherwood wrote The Petrified Forest with a theme that intelligence could no longer believe in anything, not even in itself. Clifford Odets wrote Waiting for Lefty, an attack on gangster-ridden unions. Sherwood returned with Idiot's Delight, another play revealing the horrors of war. And so it went. Plays like Dead End, Winterset, High Tor, The Women, Of Mice and Men, Golden Boy, The Little Foxes. These and many other plays, Mr. Herringbone, rang true. They were written with an eye to what was going on in the world about us. An attitude that didn't exist in your day of just entertainment in the theater, Mr. Herringbone.
But what did it all prove?
Oh, I don't know what it all proved, Mr. Herringbone. And as the 1930 decade drew to a close, men wondered what anything proved. Men were confused and looked about them desperately for something to hold to as the world rushed to the brink of chaos. And as they sought the answer, Robert Sherwood wrote a play called Abe Lincoln in Illinois. And in it, a man spoke from out of the past, and people took hope from his words. The The scene is the yards of the Springfield, Illinois railroad station on February 11th, 1861. A crowd, held back by a company of state militia, awaits the arrival of President-elect Abraham Lincoln, who will board the train that is to take him to Washington. As they wait, a major of militia gives last-minute instructions and confers with Kavanaugh, Lincoln's bodyguard.
Captain?
Yes, sir?
I want you to form your man up against this ramp.
Yes, sir.
You seem nervous, Mr. Kavanaugh.
Well, I am nervous. For 3 months, I've been guarding the life of a man who doesn't care what happens to him.
What do you mean?
Well, I heard today that we're betting 2-1 in Richmond that he won't be alive to take office on March the 4th.
I'd like to take some of that money. The state militia is competent to protect the person of our commander-in-chief.
Well, I hope the United States Army is competent to help. But those Southerners are mighty good shots. And I strongly suggest that your men be commanded to keep watch through every window of every car, especially whenever the train stops at a town or a tank or anywhere. And if any alarm is sounded at any point along the line...
There's no need to command my men to show courage in an emergency.
Now, no slur was intended, Major. But we must be prepared in advance for everything.
Let me stand back there. Keep that crowd back there, you men. I'm Mr. Lincoln's brother-in-law. What's your name?
Oh, it's all right. I know him, Major. That's Mr. and Mrs. Ninian Edwards and Mr. Speed and Mr. Herndon with them. I know them all. You can let them through.
Very well. You can pass.
Thank you very much, Major.
How's the president feeling today? Happy?
Just as gloomy as ever.
He came down to the office yesterday. When I asked him what I should do about the sign Lincoln and Herndon, he said, let it hang there. Let our clients understand that this election makes no difference to the firm. If I live, I'll be back sometime, and then we'll go right on practicing just as if nothing had happened.
He's always saying that. If I live.
Here he comes!
The president has arrived!
The president has arrived!
Hey, would you folks mind stepping back there? We want to keep this space clear for the president's party.
This is fire!
They, want you to say something, Abe.
All right, Miriam.
I have to say goodbye to you. I'm going now to Washington with my new whiskers, of which I hope you approve.
Hey, let me through here. I want to go.
It's all right. Let them come in. They're all old friends of mine.
Well, I tell you, that'd be fine. It'll be all right.
No one, not in my situation, can appreciate my feelings of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of you people, I owe everything. I have lived here a quarter of a century and passed from a young to an old man. Here my children have been born, and one is buried. I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. I am called upon to assume the presidency at a time when 11 of our sovereign states have announced their intention to secede from the Union. When threats of war increase in fierceness from day to day, it is a grave duty which I now face. In preparing for it, I've tried to inquire what great principles or ideals is it that has kept this Union so long together. And I believe that it was not the mere matter of the separation of the colonies from the motherland, but that sentiment and the Declaration of Independence, which gave liberty to the people of this country and hope to all the world. This sentiment was the fulfillment of an ancient dream which men have held through all time, that they might one day shake off their chains and find freedom in the brotherhood of life. We gain democracy. And now there is the question whether it is fit to survive. Perhaps we have come to the dreadful day of awakening, and the dream is ended. If so, I'm afraid it must be ended forever. I cannot believe that ever again will men have the opportunity we have had. Perhaps we should admit that and concede that our ideals of liberty and equality are decadent and doomed. I've heard of an Eastern monarch who once charged his wise men to invent him a sentence which would be true and appropriate in all times and situations. They presented him the words, "And this too shall pass away." That is a comforting thought in time of affliction. "And this too shall pass away." And yet, let us believe that it is not true. Let us live to prove that we can cultivate the natural world that is about us and the intellectual and moral world that is within us, so that we may secure an individual, social, and political prosperity whose course shall be forward, and which, while the earth endures, shall not pass away. I commend you to the care of the Almighty, as I hope that in your prayers you will remember. Goodbye, my friends and neighbors.
Lincoln was played by Raymond Edward Johnson, Cavanaugh his bodyguard by Fred Irving Lewis, Ninian Edwards by Jack Davis, Billy Herndon by Paul Dubov, the Major by Billy Lee. Past hour, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 24th production of its Great Plays series, a review of the American theater from 1920 to 1940, prepared by Gerald Holland. Excerpts were heard from What Price Corey by Maxwell Anderson and Lawrence Stallings, from The Show Off by George Kelly, and from Abe Lincoln in Illinois by Robert Sherwood. Next Sunday at this hour, the Great Plays series will present Robert E. Lee by John Drinkwater.